Hello, it's James. Before we get started, I just wanted to say this episode is dedicated to Neil Innes, who died this week. Very sad. Great hero of mine. Anyway, on with the show.
All right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2020. Thank you very much for coming back and listening in the podcast for, we're now in our fourth year, which is crazy. But thank you very much for listening and supporting and all that sort of stuff. Cool episode today to kick things off with a bang. I've got a bit of a two-parter. We have the interview is with Simon Donnelly. Simon Donnelly, if you don't know, is a former professional footballer who played for Celtic and Sheffield Wednesday and a couple of other clubs and for Scotland and went to the World Cup. When I was up in Scotland, it was actually when I was travelling up to Scotland for the show in November with Tony McCarroll, ended up interacted with him on Twitter a little bit and dropped him a message, and yeah, he said he was up for coming on, which is really, really cool. Love talking to people from different walks of life, and as we get into it, I used to pick him in Championship Manager when I used to play that on the PC in like 97, 98. So that was really, really cool. So we'll hear from him, and plus also I recorded with our friend Richard Bowes the other day. I did a much longer recording all about sort of the highlights of 2019 for the different ex-Oasis members, but the recording cut out, which is really annoying. But what I do have is the start of it where we talked about the process with getting the book together and all that sort of stuff. So I'm going to drop this in here so you guys can hear about that. Wouldn't be right to have a whole episode just us sort of talking about the book, really, I don't think. So anyway, putting it on here with Simon's interview, I think would work out really well. So there you go. Not any news going on really, because it's all quiet. We're just over Christmas and stuff. Liam's been quite active on Twitter, but nothing massively significant. So let's just crack on with the interview with Simon Donnelly and myself. So, welcome to the Oasis Podcast, Simon Donnelly. How you doing, man?
Good, mate.
Wonderful. New year?
Just after Christmas, so recovery. Yeah. 2020, all set to go.
Yeah. What's the what are you up to at the moment? I know you were in management for a while, and I know you've got a new business venture coming up as well.
Yeah, I got a few business ventures actually in 2019. Went into the bar trade with another three guys, so we've got a bar in Spain, which is bizarre. If you told me this time last year that I'd have a bar in Spain, I would have thought you were mad. But yeah, one or two other little ventures. I do a bit of stuff round about match days, still at Celtic Park.
Yeah.
And I'm part of an events business as well, which brings kind of ex-Celtic players back over here to do your kind of Q&As and lunches and stuff with Henrik Larsson last May. So that's going well as well. So we'll look to develop that over 2020.
That's fantastic. Do you know the guys at a Celtic State of Mind podcast?
I do, yeah. I know some of the guys there. I think I've done bits and bobs with them as well over the years since I've been back up the road after coming out of football, if you like. So yeah, I know the guys quite well.
Yeah, cool. Do you still live in and around Glasgow?
Eaglesham, just on the periphery of Glasgow, going towards Ayrshire. So yeah, it's handy enough for,
fair play.
Going to Celtic games and stuff at the weekends, it's maybe 15-20 minutes outside the city centre.
Wonderful. Did you grow up a Celtic fan?
I didn't actually. I grew up the other side, and it's not really a well-kept secret, but until I signed at Celtic at 17, you just kind of you obviously grew up what side of the fence your family are on.
Yeah.
My dad played for Rangers 4 years at Glasgow Rangers, so
yeah.
That was it until 17. But I seen the light at 17.
See, I always. It's funny now. I mean, we don't need to get into too much of that stuff, but you know, there were so many players that did swap one way or the other back in the 80s and 90s, and it didn't seem that much of a big deal. It feels like you would have thought that in the, you know, as time goes on, it would have been less of a deal, and we're more inclusive and you know, a more chilled out sort of people. But it feels like it's more of an issue now than when you look back at like Dalglish and people like that. There was a lot of people that went one side or the other.
Yeah, well, Kenny was my hero growing up. Obviously, by the time I kind of was aware of football, it was very much Liverpool and, excuse me, Scotland that I followed with Kenny. But obviously, he grew up a Rangers supporter who went on to play for Celtic, and I'm not putting myself in that bracket, but that obviously happens. And I remember at the time I was kind of maybe concerned or worried, you know, how the fans would take to me, you know, my background. I think I signed at 17 and made the first team at 19. And looking back on it now, I don't really bother about it now, you know. My heart lies with Celtic. I've had 7 fantastic years there. I work there now, as I say. My kids are all Celtic supporters, so I don't really see it as an issue.
No, I agree. And it's, I remember hearing about, you know, people that grew up in like either Manchester or Liverpool. And if like they would go and see Liverpool one week, and then if Liverpool were away, they'd go and watch Everton. It wasn't as big a deal. I think it's maybe social media that, you know, it's sort of putting it a bit more, you know, more aggressively now. I think it was a lot more chilled out back in the day.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just the madness of the rest of Scotland, really, in Glasgow. Such a big rivalry between the two sides, and you know, it's only going to get worse towards the end of this season, I reckon, because Rangers are back in the title race, and you know, it's the pressure's on for Celtic, and we've seen it on the back of the last game there just before the turn of the year, but Rangers got the edge over them, so the rivalry is going to be intense, let's say, to the end of the season.
And it's interesting that it's funny because I mean I'm a you know, I'm not an ardent Celtic fan, but they're my Scottish team, and you know, from just my sort of Irish background and stuff, I think it's kind of you know, it's sort of obligatory if you've got an Irish background you support Celtic. And so I wouldn't say I'm a supporter. I follow the results, and you know, and I'm sort of happy when they win, kind of thing. But all these years of them winning up there, I've just, you know, with Rangers not having been around, I know they've become more of a force in the last couple of years now, and they're now challenging again. I mean, I was really happy when they, you know, got relegated down, and I was just, you know, I had a big smile on my face, to be honest. That was just Schadenfreude. But we've missed them in there. You know, Scottish football has suffered from not having those big games, definitely.
Well, I think from me coming through playing at Celtic in the 90s and you know, find it tough against a really good Rangers team at the time. I think, you know, if you look at the last season or so, where Rangers have been improving, you know, the last game was huge. The cup final, the Celtic weren't at their best, but managed to go over the line, was also another massive one. And it's games like that that everybody's looking for on the fixture list now. And I think, obviously, I think there's 2 points between them, with Rangers with a game in hand. You know, it was really tight at this stage last year, and Rangers kind of fell away after the winter break. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes this year, you know, because as much as Celtic have had, you know, the likes of Aberdeen round about them, the teams have always tended to fall away. So as I say, if Rangers are there towards the end, it'll be intense, you know, and it'll be a different pressure for Celtic. But as I say, with my allegiances, hopefully they can go on to make it the 9. It's a big one for them this season. You know, the aspirations are there to go and break the record that Rangers and the Lisbon Lions hold of 9. So, you know, it's all to play for.
No, absolutely. And going back to your time, I know you were playing for Celtic at a time when Rangers were the dominant force, but I suppose the one big thing that you guys managed was that you stopped the 10 in a row.
That was important. That was important. And at the time, I think I was 24 at the time, and although you feel the pressure and you're going through it, it's, you, you maybe don't appreciate how big it was until you're sitting at 45 looking back on it, you know, and you can take that wee bit of pride that you played your part in it, because it was, you know, it was a monumental moment in Celtic's history, you know, preserving the nine in a row of the Lisbon Lions all those years before. So yeah, that was my one and only title, but quite an important one.
Yeah, definitely very, you know, really important when you look at, I mean, as a down south, I'm a Man United fan as well, and so there are years, yeah, when you're like, I don't even remember, you know, 2006-07, you know, I don't, you know, certain seasons stick out, and especially so all of those seasons where they've won. I was just looking at a picture earlier, and someone's put a picture of Brown holding a couple of trophies, and it's like, the thing is, you don't even know what season that is, you know, it's like it was brilliant. It's like, well, you just don't even know, and whereas you guys, I say, you might have only won that one, but you know, that's one that people, that 97-98 was such an important year for them, and it will be huge in their memory, especially someone like me. I was 18 at the time. And and also, I think the big thing is as well, when we first got in contact a couple of months ago, I was like, I used to pick you in Championship Manager, like, because I would always...
It's funny that, because I was away at New Year there to St Andrews with the family, and my nephews and my pals were asking me, they got all around the TV screen playing FIFA or PES or whatever it is they play, and they were asking me, were you ever in that? And I think I missed out in that, you know, so I'm glad to hear that I made Championship Manager.
No, you were good in Championship Manager, if you could, because you were versatile. You were, I think you were attacking mid, right attacking mid, or striker. So yeah, you're a very versatile person to have in there, you see.
but you're right what you say about different things. I mean, you're talking about Man United, that 99, obviously, European Cup, and that marvellous football team as well. As I said earlier on, growing up, I followed the Liverpool side of the 80s with Dalglish, probably because my dad influenced me. You know, there was a few Scottish players in that team. It was a wonderful team. And then when I was breaking through at Celtic in the early 90s, I could relate to the five or six young kids that were breaking in at Man United. You know, I was always looking over my shoulder at the English version of it, and then Cantona coming in. You know, that was a big influence in my career, you know, watching that team as well.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. And I think I mentioned to you last night, like, I was just flicking through some old YouTube videos, and I kind of always get confused of, you know, well, what year was this and who came in at what point? And I'd even forgot that you had a couple of seasons with Henrik Larsson. I mean, yeah. I mean, how was it playing with someone like Henrik?
It was amazing. I mean, I went on record as saying he's probably the best I've played with. You know, I've played with some fantastic players over the years. You know, when I first came in, like I said, Paul McStay was in the first team at Celtic. Charlie Nicholas was coming to the end of his career, but I had a spell up front with him. Yeah, learned a lot of him, and then you had the foreign guys like Van Hooijdonk, Candy Toms, the Canyons that came in round about the 95-96 period through under Tommy Burns. It was great education for me, but when Henrik came, you know, there was a spell that season where we won the league, that at the beginning of the season, through fault, actually, we ended up playing up front. Darren Jackson had taken ill, and he'd be meant to be playing in a game in Europe, and I came in and ended up scoring two and finding myself on the team for maybe a 10-15 game stretch with Henrik up front before Harold came in. Harold brought back later on in the season, and I kind of changed position again. You talk about the kind of versatility, ended up playing on the right of midfield again. But to play with a guy of that calibre, and again, I've said it as well, I think he raised his game even after I left. I only had two seasons with Henrik. What he went on to achieve at Celtic in the next 4 or 5 years. And then, you know, everybody kind of said, oh, well, he can only do it in the Scottish game. He can only get 50 goals in the Scottish game. And, of course, he goes to Barcelona and wins the European Cup, actually makes the two goals off the bench, and then has a spell at your own club.
Rooney on to Carrick. Here's Ronaldo. Rooney. Still Rooney. Sets it up for Larsson! He's done it! He's scored on his Manchester United debut! The smile says it all! Martin O'Neill knew all about the threat his former Celtic star posed. Now that threat has come home to roost. Henrik Larsson scores within an hour of his first appearance. the famous red of Manchester United.
34, 35, where I don't think Fergie wanted them to leave. You know, I think Henrik Ben Henrik, he gave his word to his local club that he would go back and see the season out there.
Mm.
You know, where I think a lot of Man United fans would have wanted them to stick about that season. So, yeah, just really privileged to have played with him. You know, and there's been a couple of games in recent years, you know, kind of charity games where I've got a chance to take to the field with him again. So it's all good.
Mm. Is he a good bloke in real life?
He's a great lad. He's a great lad. We worked with him last year through our company First Start. We had him over for 4 days and he did a lunch with us. And very, very private guy, Henrik. And sometimes if you don't know him, that can be taken the wrong way. But humble, you know, and for everything he's achieved in the game, he can just speak to you on a level. Just a classy operator.
Fantastic. And what about, before we move on from football, I just wanted to ask you about Di Canio, because, I mean, you know, once again, if you talk about a character, you know, problem around that time was that, you know, it was sort of everything was kind of focused around Di Canio once you sort of brought him in, and maybe that sort of the players around him would have suffered under it. But, and also, what was he like in the dressing room as well? Was he as mad as people here?
Yeah, completely. A good guy, but completely mad, you know, and wasn't shy about it either. You know, he came in, but I always say to people, and especially when I was working in football as a coach, in terms of how you go and apply yourself in a training pitch, he was one of the hardest trainers that I'd came across, and that's the kind of lasting memory I have of my time with Paolo. You can take all the talent there that he had, which was evident, you know, everybody's seen that on a Saturday, but how he worked behind the scenes was incredible. Just a total professional, and you know, it was an eye opener to me, because you know, flair players like that, you think at times, oh well, they'll die, they'll play in and out of games, and they'll maybe not work as hard in training, but that guy worked, and everything he achieved, it was a kind of a lesson to myself. You know, you look at them and say, yeah, you can only see that on a Saturday 90 minutes, but the work that goes on behind the scenes is why he was so good.
Wow, that's fantastic. And yeah, and you went to a World Cup as well. I know you didn't get on the pitch, but I mean, that must have been incredible to be off at the World Cup, France 98.
It was great, and it came on the back of that season that we won the league. I think there was 7 or 8 of that squad went to France with the Scotland squad. Fantastic experience. We were based in the south of France. The weather was great. We trained in the morning. The food in the hotel, all the experience, but I just wish I'd played. You know, the 3 games came and went. We turned up at the opening game of the World Cup against Brazil. We all came in the kilts. It was a secret, you know, because there was no real social media then, so it was easy to keep the secret. And we came out, and the reception we got off the Tartan Army was brilliant. I remember all that, but you just want to say you've played. And I think we got down to the Morocco game, and I think we were getting turned over 3-0. Craig Burley had been sent off, and Craig Brown told me and Scott Booth to go out and warm up, and you're warming up, and I think even though it's 3-0, you should just put me on the pitch so that I can go home and say to my friends and family that I played at World Cup. And he called us back in and put Scott Booth on, and it was the third sub. So that was my experience, but I wouldn't change it, you know. And out with wanting to play, it was a fantastic experience, and to be picked for your country to go to the World Cup, you know, obviously we haven't qualified since, which is hard to believe, but it was a good experience.
And did you were you in the video, the Delamitri Don't Come Home Too Soon video?
I remember going to the studio. I was more nervous about singing with Delamitri than I was playing football. That was bizarre. We all went to record it. Don't come home too soon. Unfortunately, we did.
Yeah, I know. It's such a, you know, but it's so funny because it's a really great, it's a beautiful song. It's one of the best sort of football songs ever made, I think. But it's so.
It's up there. It's not as good as World in Motion. I would give World in Motion 1990 maybe a wee bit, but Delamitri were a band that I grew up with, you know, listen to. So to go and record a song was a surreal experience.
So long, go on and do your best. Let all friends have whiskey on its breath. The world may not be shaken yet, but you might prove them wrong. Even long shots make it.
But it was such a defeatist song, wasn't it? Like, you know, oh, please.
It's typical Scottish, mate. Typical Scottish.
Unless you're
Ally McLeod in 78, where he thought we were going to win it.
Yeah, exactly. Ally's Army win the World Cup. Yeah, no, it's amazing. I rewatched the video this morning, actually. I forgot that you guys do a... because there was the famous NICAD with Brazil, and you guys are doing that, but Colin Hendry doing the keepy up, he's not quite got, you know, the Ronaldo skills.
I remember in the tunnel before that game, and they were standing looking amazing beside us, as you can imagine, in the Brazil home kit, and Ronaldo had the new silver boots on, which weren't really, I mean, nowadays there's all multicoloured boots, but back then, and the whole Scottish team were transfixed on this guy's boots, and me, Craig Brown, came through at the back and says, look at them, they're shiting themselves, boys. I don't think they were, mate. I don't think they were. So it was bizarre. Good to be involved with.
Yeah, well, just to give you my history of it, that was the first day of my... I just finished my A-levels at 18 years old. And that was my... that was like literally, you know, the last exam finished, and it was straight down the pub, first game of the World Cup, Scotland-Brazil. And so that summer of 98 was magic. And you guys qualifying for the World Cup were a big part of that, because we were cheering on Scotland, although I did laugh when you lost, to be honest, so I'm sorry about that.
South of France on holidays shortly after that, and applauded the Michael Owen scored a fantastic goal, was it against Argentina?
Yeah.
I remember getting up in the pub and applauding that. It was a fantastic goal.
But then, so Delamitri, you mentioned about that, but I mean, music, was that a big part of your life growing up?
Yeah, 100%. I think that is right until this day. You know, I've always loved music. I don't claim to be an expert. I've had a bit of stick on social media for what I like, but what I like is what I like. I've got a guitar in my bedroom that I can play about three or four chords badly. My kids leave the room. But no, I grew up, obviously, 15, 16. It was a mate and his older brother that influenced me with the Stone Roses.
Oh, great.
And at the time, I was like, Guns N' Roses, I was like, what? Who's the Stone Roses? But as soon as I started listening to that kind of Manchester scene, I was hooked. You know, Charlatans, all these bands, going back to New Order before them. But it was heavily influenced through a mate's older brother, who obviously had good taste in music.
And what about then coming through at Celtic? Were the other guys into music as much? And was it tend to be indie stuff?
See, to be honest, see, when I broke in to the first team, there was a wee bit of an age gap. I think Jackie McNamara came in '95, who was a year older than me, but there was a little gap, you know.
A lot of older guys.
Late 20s, 30s, and they weren't maybe like, we were the kind of two young kids, if you like, in the dressing room. So when it was like Oasis coming into the fold, there wasn't... A mate, Brian McLaughlin, who was a big U2 fan, I remember that. But there wasn't really anybody out with us that were really into that kind of scene. I'd kind of came through my latter years at school with the baggy jeans and all that carry on, and probably thought I was something out of Oasis. Looking back at the early 90s, which is a wee bit embarrassing, but that was my that was my kind of scene. And we were fortunate enough to see, I think I was at 7 or 8 Oasis gigs at that time, dotted all over Britain. So it was a good time, but I think because the other boys were a wee bit older, our music tastes were a wee bit different.
So would it be, you know, who would be in charge of the, they always talk about, you know, with England and Forest, it'd be Stuart Pearce in charge of the stereo and sticking on Sex Pistols and stuff. Who would you be trying to wrestle the stereo away and stick on a bit of Oasis?
No, back then you kind of, you knew your place a wee bit, you know, you were in a dressing room, but if I was listening to music, it would have been on headphones somewhere tucked up in the back of the bus.
Okay.
I would never ever have tried to put my music on, even though I got near the front of the bus.
Fair enough. I suppose what about the likes of like big Pierre Van Hooijdonk? Would he sort of take over? He seems like an intimidating character.
No, big Pierre's, I keep in touch with Pierre. He's a great lad. I don't remember him. I don't remember him having any real music taste, to be honest. Nothing jumps out at me. He's a fantastic guy. I keep in touch with his son's actually doing really well in Holland.
Oh, yeah.
Just now he's playing with Breda, which I think was Pierre's first team. But in terms of music, I think he probably were the, although we're the youngest, we probably had the coolest taste in music.
Yeah.
Even like Jackie and two or three of the younger ones.
Yeah, no, fair play. It's crazy that, you know, with I was just talking, we were just sort of doing a roundup of the year 2019 in the world of the Gallaghers, and Liam's singles came out, you know, and sort of in the UK charts have hit, I think Shockwave went to number 22. In the Scotland only charts, Shockwave went to number one. You know, like, you know, it's mad that in the UK as a whole, Scotland is still, I did a couple of whole episodes around it when we were doing the Glasgow show at the end of last year, and just the passion for indie music and the passion for guitar music and Oasis especially in Scotland is just amazing. Like, you know, probably the strongest in the country and maybe even the world.
Well, I think Glasgow is very similar to Manchester in a way, you know, in terms of football, music, these kind of passions. And obviously with Oasis, the story goes about the King Tuts and Alan McGee spotting them in Scotland has always kind of been held well with the Scottish support.
Yeah.
You know, and I was at Irvine Beach in 1995, I think. Gig, the Verve were supporting them, and at that time, due to total ignorance, I was like, I didn't go in and watch the Verve, can you believe that? I never actually went to the tent to watch for the Verve, because I didn't know who they were, and I was only there to see Oasis, and then I was lucky enough through a friend who played in Teenage Fan Club, managed to get me tickets through Creation Records for the Loch Lomond gigs, back-to-back nights, which were amazing. People put up on social media, what gig would you like? I would go to that one all day long, Loch Lomond. We were there both nights. I remember playing it, I think it was pre-season friendly against Sporting Lisbon in the afternoon, and we got a bus with Celtic Park down to Loch Lomond. And I think I was there on the Sunday as well, if it was Saturday, Sunday. It was definitely both gigs. But the Scottish side of it, it's strong, and I think the guys have went on record as well as saying they love playing here.
Yeah.
And Gallagher was up there just at the turn of the year, never managed to, Liam was up playing the Hydro.
Yeah.
Never managed to get along to it, but I remember looking at his social media, and I think the guys get a buzz out of playing up here as well.
Oh, absolutely. Is the maddest crowds like, you know, have I been to a gig in Glasgow? No, I've never been to a gig in Glasgow, actually, but like, that's generally what you hear is the maddest crowds are like Glasgow, Dublin, Manchester, and then like, you know, Argentina and Japan, like, you know, but it's right up there, right up there. So you mentioned that you've, I think you haven't met the Gallaghers, but you met Bonehead, is that right?
I met Bonehead. It was bizarre, but so me and my mate, again, managed to get tickets. It was Newcastle, at the Exhibition Centre in Newcastle. And it was the same night Newcastle were playing Barcelona in the Champions League. I think they drew 3 each. And the city was just electric, as you can imagine. And we were going to the gig. And I must have had tickets off. It might have been through Paul Quinn again at PH Fan Club, because we went after the gig into, was it an after party, but it was like a little room where guests were allowed to hang about and get a couple of drinks after it. And there was a guy swaggering about who obviously thought he was Liam Gallagher, but it definitely was not him. And the next time Bonehead came in. So it was just, it was a brief hello, that was it. But I've never had the fortune to meet.
By the way, Scotland's a beautiful country. The people are magnificent. Get yourself up there. I am he, you are me. We are all together. Mwah!
You're quite active on social media, and you do quite a lot of like promoting and pushing new music as well. I mean, is music sort of still a big part of your life now? Listen to music a lot.
As I think the good things from social media is, I mean, the guys, the Lathams or the Lathams, I don't know how you pronounce it, somebody asked me to retweet something last year, and I'm all for helping people promote anything, you know, if it's a band or whatever. So I'd retweeted it, and the guys, by all accounts, are going to go through the roof this year. I really like some of the songs. I've been working with a kid who I just discovered on Twitter, a boy called Adam Frame. He was actually playing a Stone Roses song, and I had my Don McNamara's, that's the name of our puppet, my Don McNamara's hat on, and I went to him and said, look, would you come over and play in our bar? Because as much as we like to get some ex-players over doing Q&As, you can't beat a bit of live music in a bar. So that was my thoughts behind it. And he came over and he played. I've developed a friendship with him and his dad, and I'm trying to help him in his, you know, the first bit of his career. He's a fantastic talent, so I don't claim to be any sort of music guru, but if you can help somebody and give them a wee platform, he came along and came along and played at John Hartson's charity foundation just before the turn of the year there in front of 600 people. If you can give somebody a little, you know, help and put them on the way, then I'm all for it. And he's got a big future, I believe. You know, he's a fantastic young boy, and it's a hard game, music, I think. I think it's harder than football.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bands out there trying to make their mark. But yeah, it's something I'm quite passionate about. I can say she's been there for us. I can say she's been there for us. Oh no, she don't need anybody. Oh no, she don't need anyone. Saying, listen, I'd like to help you. There'll be wee things in your career and your path that's a fortune, and take them when they come along. And the week later, he was in playing his gig and he met the DMAs. Don't know if you're familiar with
them. Yeah,
yeah. They were supporting Liam Gallagher. They had a day off. If you go on my social media or Adam Friend's social media, you'll see it, the guy went up and played two songs with the kid, and the boy had went to see him or see the band at the Barrowlands a year before. So he was loving every moment of it. If you watch the video, he goes from one song into the next without stopping, and I was like, why did you do that? He says, because I had the guy Tommy for DMAs there. I didn't want to, you know, give up the moment. It's a really good piece of video. So that's the wee bits of luck. He got a lot of following on the back of that on his social media. So sometimes you need to be right place at the right time kind of thing, but he's definitely got the talent.
Oh, that's fantastic, and good on you, Simon, for supporting them. That's it. You could be the next Alan McGee. You never know.
I don't know about that. I like music. You know, as I say, I take a wee bit of stick now and again if I stick something up. But you like what you like.
Exactly. Now that's really cool. And what about going back on the Oasis thing? I mean, what did you think? Did you carry on following them all throughout the 2000s? Then you said you went to quite a few gigs.
Irvine, I think, was the first one. When I moved to Sheffield, I seen them at the Sheffield Arena. And when I was at Celtic, I actually went down to Earls Court. Me and a couple of the boys, we played Motherwell on the Saturday, and we flew straight down after the game and came back nursing a hangover on Monday morning for training. But looking back, some great times, some great gigs. And yeah, followed them right through. And I'm one of these guys that I want to see them back. I know the problems are there. I don't know if it's most of it's hype or if it's real or what. Does anybody know? But I'd love to see them. I'd love to take my kids actually to an Oasis gig and show them, because they like their music as well. Liam's doing really well just now. Noel's had a great solo career, but it'd be great to get the band back together, as they say.
Yeah, no, I know. We were just doing the roundup of the year kind of interview, and it was basically like everything that Liam's got and is lacking is what Noel's got and is lacking. You know, it's the yin yang symbol or whatever. It's like that acquiesce. They need each other. You know, that's
each other, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I agree with that. I mean, I think what Liam's did, you know, after BDI and stuff and came back again, and not really reinvented himself, but he's come back with some cracking tunes. His tours are sold out. I watched his film. I think the story behind it is great, because when you've been in a band like Oasis and you come out of that kind of bubble, as he describes it, to go back, you know, all these years later, I mean, he's older than me, the guy. I think it's like me getting back and playing football. We must get some buzz out of it, because, I mean, unfortunately in football, physically, you can't do it anymore. I play fives and I play in charity games, as I said earlier on with Henrik, but to get that opportunity to go and do the real deal again, it must have some buzz out of that. But for me, being a big Oasis fan, I mean, out with the Roses, they're my next best band. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see the guys get back together. I was fortunate enough to see that happen with Stone Roses. You know, I went to Tea in the Park and Glasgow Green to see those guys when at one stage you thought they were never going to get back. So it'd be great to see it. Whether it happens, who knows?
Yeah, no, absolutely wonderful. All right, Simon, well, thank you so much for your time. What we always tend to finish off with here, I don't think I warned you about this, is your favorite Oasis song, or what you'd at least one that means a lot to you. So what you got?
Really difficult question, these ones. It's very hard to look at that many good ones. I really like Rocking Chair.
Great choice.
It's not the obvious choice, but I think it's a cracking tune.
It is. It's beautiful, and I think that something like Rocking Chair, like it's amazing that Noel was only 25 when he wrote that, you know, and yet it feels like someone, you know, a much older, much wiser person has written that song. It's such an incredible, yeah, such
the
a
the tunes the guy wrote. I mean, the songs the guy wrote are amazing. That one sticks in my head because I get a picture 10, 15, 20, but. I heard a really cool version of it the other day online. It was just Liam's voice. Somebody put it up, and it was just Liam in a studio just singing that song just with his voice. It sounded amazing.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'll have to dig that out. Wonderful. Simon, we'll finish up with Rocking Chair. But, yeah, thank you so much for your time. Good luck with Don McNamara's. Good luck with your sort of the lunches and things, the Celtic player stuff, and yeah, all the best.
Okay, thanks.
Cheers, Simon.
Cheers, man. I don't care for your attitude. You bring me down, I think you're rude. All my life, I try to make a better day. Deciding I've been alone. Sitting here by the phone. Waiting for my memories to come and play.
So thank you very much to Simon. Really enjoyed that. Great to speak to him. And yeah, I love speaking to footballers and stuff. It's just great for me as like someone that grew up knowing these names, and now I get to speak to them about Oasis and find out a bit more about their lives and stuff. I love it. And as I say, although I'm Celtic and Man United, but I'm more than happy to speak to footballers from other clubs. So if you know, like, there's a particular footballer from your club that, or other sports person that, you know, is really into Oasis, you know, we've spoken to Ricky Atten, we've spoken to Ken Doherty. Love speaking to sports people. So if you know them, you can get me in touch with them. Be more than happy to speak to them. Right, let's cross over now to the chat I had. If you want a bit more background about the book and how that came about, me and Richard Bowes, who's physically written the thing, have sat down and talked about it. So let's cross over to me talking to Richard Bowes. Paperback Writer. You sit all night when you read my book. It appears to write. Will you take a look? It's based on a novel by a man named Lear, and I need a job, so I want to be a paperback writer. All right, welcome back to the Oasis podcast and Happy New Year, Richard Bowes.
Happy New Year to you, James. How are we doing?
I'm good. I think so. Is it, what year is it? I don't know what's going on.
It's 2020, because all the 2020 visions gags have been coming around. So yeah, it's 2020.
Yeah, 2020 vision, and like people posting pictures of schnapps and saying, oh, if you're a 90s kid, you remember getting pissed on these in the park and stuff.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, classic. But the biggest news, I suppose, and the special announcement episode came out a little while ago, just before Christmas, is there's a book coming. There's a book coming. Yeah, the Oasis podcast book, which I've had very little to do with, which is great. So yeah. Do you want? So yeah, tell me about that. How are you feeling about it?
Let's go through a bit of the back history. Really, you might as well start from the beginning. So, when you first started the podcast in, you know, 2017, as I'm sure you recall, I did a few articles for you, and I do a few things on the Patreon and stuff like that. I'd had a bit of a history in, well, I'd had a bit of previous in doing some music writing, and kind of lapsed out of it for a few years because I got married and all the stuff that comes around that. It didn't become a priority, but I kind of thought, well, you know, I'd like to start getting back into that again. Hence why, you know, I kind of, well, not why I approached you about the podcast, but that was kind of in my line of thinking about those, or the few articles that I did on the post. And then I thought to myself, I think I seem to remember listening to one of the podcast episodes, actually. I can't remember who you were interviewing, but you said you were talking about an Oasis equivalent of Revolution in the Head, the Beatles Revolution in the Head.
Yes.
And I remember, I can't remember the interview, but I remember thinking, oh, that's an interesting idea. But then I thought, well, actually, I don't have the musical proficiency to go through all the kind of that in detail, but what I do kind of have is a bit of a knowledge of, you know, pretty much the band from start to finish, you know following their whole kind of story, and I had a thing where I, you know, could name you the chart positions of any of their singles and that sort of thing, and I have a weird kind of encyclopedic head like that when it comes to the dates and stuff like that. So I thought, oh, that'd be an interesting idea. And then as I was kind of percolating those thoughts in my head, you were then approached at the Ken Womack book launch.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so just to fill in, so it was actually the Ken Womack episode that where that came up. It's just strange. It's just strange that it hasn't had that level. Because, let's say, in 1996, 97, if you went into like a bookshop, a record shop, there were stacks of books about Oasis. But there's been nothing that's actually chronicled their career. You know, there's been nothing that's sort of followed them all the way through to sort of 2008.
Okay, well, then I'll say it because I know it's on your listeners' mind. Why are you not writing that book?
Because I never learned to read and write. That's why I do a podcast. That's why podcasters do it.
But okay, no, I have a feeling you're literate, so... and you don't have to read Virginia Woolf to be able to write that book. Look, there are 3,000 books on the Beatles.
3,000.
Something like that, right? I mean, it's the latest number I've heard. And most of them probably don't have a need for space on the bookshelf. I may have even been the cause of some of that at some point or another. but the point I'm trying to make is my most recent interest when I decided to write the George Martin biography, for example, or the Beatles Encyclopedia, yes. I did that because those are the books I wish I had on my shelf.
Yes.
Right? So what book do you wish you had on your shelf? You want the career retrospective from a certain point,
yeah.
from beginning to end.
I want Revolution in the Head of Oasis.
Sure, or maybe Revolution in the Head. Why don't you write that book?
So it's something I've thought about for ages is like an Oasis book. Either a Revolution in the Head, and if people haven't read Revolution in the Head, it's basically a song by song. You know, it starts mm-hmm. off with like the very first Beatles songs and it goes through all the way to the very last Beatles songs. And it's like breaks them, each of them down and, you know, talks about the different, you know, the both the lyrics. And like we do on the Oasis A to Z here, but in a book format. And obviously they did them all, you know, we're not still in the seas like we are on the Oasis A to Z. Yeah, and so I'd love that. You know, I'd love just a book that detailed every individual song or, you know, a book that covers the entire history of Oasis because it doesn't exist, right? You know, there isn't a book. There's all those books came out in the first couple of years, Paulo Hewitt and Paul Gallagher and Ian Robertson. All those ones cover that first couple of years. And then you've got Tony McCarroll's the only member of Oasis that's written his story, but obviously his story ends pretty much in March 95. And so, there's this huge gap in the market, as far as I see, for a book that covered the whole thing. So, so then I was at this book launch with Ken Womack, who's American, who'd come over from America to sort of launch this George Martin book. And just started chatting to the publisher there, this woman, Helen, from Orphan Publishing. And I was just saying, you know, there's a gap in the market for it. She didn't have a bloody clue about anything about Oasis. She's like, oh, yeah, wait, that's the two brothers, isn't it? Oh, I never liked them. Which one's the nice one? And I'm like, well...
depends on your point of view.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe ask people online.
Paul?
Yeah, exactly, Paul. Well, I don't know about that, actually. Yeah, and then she was like, okay, that's interesting. Well, send me some info on it, and then we'll have a think about that. And then was that then when I contacted you then?
Yeah, so what I remember it vividly, I remember waking up to you tweeted, you sent out a tweet saying you were approached about a book, and my immediate reaction was, shit.
that was my idea.
That was my reaction, like, oh, no, this could be awkward. But then I can't remember if you approached me or approached a group of people, or you just put it out there as to say who'd be interested in doing this. But there was initially a thing, wasn't there, that we put together a bit of a framework, and there were a few people kind of put their hats in the ring.
That's right. I remember now. So what I did is I'd kind of came up with the premise, which was the entire, you know, the history of Oasis book. And I put it out there on, I don't know if I put it on Twitter or if I'd messaged a few people who I knew that did a bit of writing. Like the different, because there was yourself and there was like a few other people that had done some writing for the Patreon, and a couple of other people that I knew were right, had done other bits of writing. And so I sort of did, I think I did a group message to about 5 or 6 different people and said, look, you know, who's, you know, are you guys interested? And I just thought it might be like, you know, people do 3 chapters each or something like that. Or then, you know, you might do a history chapter and then it might be like a chapter that was
school and things like
about a specific issue or something like that. Yeah. Or, you know, if we got Katie George used to a chapter, she could do a, you know, she's done brilliant writing on Oasis, and so she could do a whole thing about that female fan's perspective and things like that. That would have been really good. But yeah, and a couple of people did submit bits, and then but then you just really took the bull by the horns and started writing the whole thing. And
well, yeah, but basically what happened for me was the ideas were kind of going back and forth. You know, as you say, the emails were going back and forth, and I thought, well, sod it, I'm just going to get on with it. I'm just going to start it. And for me, I thought, well, what I want to do is, as you touched upon a minute ago, the 90s stuff has been well documented by countless sources. For me, what's more interesting, well, not more interesting, but by virtue of the fact it's lesser known, is from the year 2000 or 99 onwards. So I thought, right, I'm going to stake my claim with that. I'm going to start working on that. And, you know, when it arises, I can say, well, I've done this for it. And it was initially started very much at the beginning. Well, actually round about from when Creation folded, kind of just started as a sort of history from there. And I included, because I was at the Wembley Stadium gigs, you know, the infamous one. So I kind of included that as a kind of fans piece.
Mm.
And then just kind of carried on from there, really. So like did the whole the year 2000, and then I thought, oh, actually, then they went on to do the Rock and Rio shows and the tour of Brotherly Love, you know, across America in 2001. Mm-hmm. That'd be quite interesting. And kind of just carried on and carried on and carried on. And before I knew it, I got to the end of 2009. So I was just battering away, really. But yeah, it was, you know, genuinely a labour of love. I thought, you know, I was actually quite enjoying this. And then I think it was around about that time. I wrote a couple of other sort of more detailed excerpts, like about the story about Liam losing his teeth in Munich, and I wrote a few more detailed things about it, a couple of other fan experiences. But around about that time, I think that's kind of took to about, I don't know, March, April 2018. Then I think you were back in contact with Orphans, and then it kind of... Oh, no, actually, I'd written the transcript, hadn't I? I did the transcript of the Wembley gigs.
Mm.
And and then you spoke to Orphans, didn't you? And it kind of... They kind of got a bit cold feet.
Yeah, so basically... so I'd written kind of the outline, which they sort of liked the look of, and said, you know, well, give us sort of an example kind of paragraph. Just let you know, Orphan Publishing has done some cool stuff. It's done the George Martin book. It's done a couple of other sort of Beatles-related things, a few other sort of, you know, music-y things. But originally, they were set up, the reason they're Orphans is they're set up like a charity for orphans, you know, that was how they were originally set up. So they have got sort of more of a wholesome sort of image. And the chapter that we sent them was the Wembley 2000 chapter that had this whole transcript of Liam doing this.
Yeah, in hindsight, probably not the best choice.
Yeah, maybe not. But doing this massive rant about Patsy Kensett not leaving him a tea bag and all that sort of stuff.
I watched his football pitch, man, since he was about 3 and a half. Do you want to know what's good about it? I never thought a beer with a bunch of mates and that, having it fucking large. And I don't care about fucking, you're a rock star, you're this, you're having it fucking large. I'm playing Wembley Stadium, and I'm not, I'm doing it with my mates. It's about time some fucking excitement happened in this fucking shit all around.
And Helen sort of phoned me and said, James, there's a lot of swearing and drug taking and alcohol in this Oasis story, isn't there? I'm like, yeah, that's kind of their thing. So, oh, you know, I'm really sorry, but I don't think this is the fit for us. You know, that this is not... I wasn't expecting it to be like that. I should have known, but, you know... And I think she was really interested in the project. And actually, since then, you know, I have been in touch with her a few times and asked her a few questions, and she's been really, really helpful. And also, we've still done another couple of bits helping out Ken Womack on his second part of the George Martin book. So, you know, nothing but love for them. She was just like... We can't do this. We can't put out that book. So
fair enough.
We could have done a very timid version of the Oasis story that didn't have any of the sex, drugs, rock and roll and fighting in it, but that wouldn't be the Oasis story, right?
Yeah. We were quite in agreement then that we thought, well, yeah, it's if the alternative is to not have a publisher or an interest from publishers, but, you know, not tell the story. I think we were both of the same thought. We thought, well, you can't have that. It's not, it just, as you say, it's just it's part and parcel of the band, whether you like it or not. Exactly. And to not include it, you know, I mean, the fourth single, it was called Cigarettes and Alcohol, for God's sake, you know, you can't not include it. It's just par for the course, and to not include that would have just been, well, wouldn't have been doing the whole theme justice, really.
Exactly. So then what happens? So then you go away and just carry on writing the thing. We said, you know, oh, well, we'll just leave it and see what happens. Then, it went a bit quiet on that front, I suppose, because you were actually writing it.
Yeah, so I was, well, we kind of, I think in that interim period as well, when it was all going on, I think we kind of said, well, what we'll do, well, part of the original idea was take extracts in the interviews and so on and so forth. And then we just kind of said, well, let's just keep going, see what happens. So as I say, I got to the end of like the 2009, I got to the split, and I thought, well, I'm halfway there now. I've done half the story in it, and so I might as well go back to the beginning and try and tie them up. So I then went, yeah, right back to the very beginning, and did the whole story, taking it up to the year 2000, and then kind of tied those two ends together. Pulled out a lot of my kind of fan takes and own experiences, because by that point it's becoming a tome, and I thought, well, there's no point, you know, I wasn't there for the recordings, at Monmouth and all that sort of stuff, so there's no point sometimes having it as a fan story and sometimes not. So I took away kind of my own personal experiences, and then it got to the stage where it had more or less certainly an outline or a guide from sort of 91 to 2009, and I then went back and thought, well, that's the framework, I've got that. So I then went back and started doing the transcribing of the podcast interviews, which was long.
And you would have had to listen to a lot of me sort of talking as well, which is was there any software or something you could have used, or was it no, you just had to physically sit there and type the stuff out?
I probably could have done had I kind of looked into it, but even then, you kind of, because of the nature of conversations and the nature of the interviews you do, you know, you not saying this is a disservice, but you know, you sometimes digress and then come back to the subject in hand.
No,
you know, but no, yeah, sorry, wrong podcast.
How dare you?
but the software would only, from my very limited understanding, my software would only kind of take the whole conversation. There'd be no punctuation. I don't know if it'd necessarily split the two voices. So it was a case of, well, that just sounds like it's creating a job in and of itself.
Yeah.
So it's probably, so for me, it was thought, right, I just did it the old fashioned way. So went through, listened to all the relevant interviews from start to finish. It wasn't just me as well. I should at this point give a shout out to Amy F. Spot, who very kindly did some transcriptions for me. Yeah, bless her. She did a couple for me. Not for me. She did a few, actually, which was very useful. It was a case of just going through and, yeah, just picking through and then taking the bits that were relevant to the story, i.e. little anecdotes or whatever, and then going through and trying to remove the punctuation as well, because obviously people don't, you know, you can't read the printed word in the way that people talk. So going back, that's very much an ongoing process. I'm sure there'll still be a lot of that to do, probably. Just going through and just, yeah, trying to piece everything together that I felt would be relevant to the actual chronology, really. So that went, that was from about, I probably finished the main manuscript in, I don't know, summer last year. And then, yeah, probably from September till about February, March was just doing, well, February till about June, really, next year. Oh, no, sorry, September to June 2019, just doing more and more transcriptions. Eventually got up to date with everything that was relevant. And then, you know, you very kindly would pass me some interviews that you'd done, got little bonuses before the episodes were released. So I kind of transcribed those, add those in, and then kind of build it up from there, really. And then before you knew it, yeah, it was getting to the stage where it was, to all intents and purposes, done. I was just adding the interview bits. I did. I was a little bit reluctant at first because there's always the potential for you to get more interviews, obviously. But then I had a conversation with my wife, and I was like, I said, what's happening with this then? You've done all this. What are you doing now? I was like, well, you know, James might get so and so someone else in, or, you know, there's always the holy grail of Liam he might get one day. And, you know, I know he's always trying to speak to other people. And she was like, yeah, but the podcast isn't going to go away, is it? You know, it's going to be, you can always find some other reason not to do it. Why didn't you actually start trying to speak to people? So, and then by happenstance, around about that time, I was followed by someone on Twitter, well, an account on Twitter, which was a book about the Smiths called The Day I Was There. I made contact with that author and said, your book looks quite similar to something I'm working on. And he gave me a name of the of a contact at This Day Music, and just said, yeah, tell him I sent you, essentially.
Mm. And so that was really cool. And so then so was that Neil, or was that one of the other guys?
That was Neil, yeah.
Yeah, so that was Neil. So there's this guy, Neil Kossar, who I don't think you'll mind us mentioning. And so you've just contacted him kind of out of the blue, a bit unsolicited, or like, well,
yeah,
you know. And you'd think that, like, you'll hear stories of like people trying to get books done, of like, you know, sending, you know, to 50 different publishers, and it's like literally your first one, and you're like, I know. Oh yeah, you don't know who I am, but I think I might write a book about, I've got a book about Oasis, do you want to do it? And then where do we go from there?
Well, they basically said yes. I mean, I would hate to sound blasé about it, but that's pretty much what happened. So you and I kind of went back and forth. You know, I did the pitch using some of the sort of the blurb or the outline that you'd taken from the book itself, kind of amalgamated that to make it appealing. And yeah, they just came back within the day and said, yeah, we'd like to hear more about this, and kind of started asking a few questions, and the conversation started from there. And then, yes, it was effectively one shot, one kill, to use GoldenEye rules.
everything's 90s. Everything's 90s.
It's always 90s. and yeah, it was. I now look back on it and think, that seemed a little bit too easy. Should I have done a bit more research, or should I have maybe scoped out for other people's stuff? But, you know, we then arranged the meeting, and, you know, obviously you were there, and we met with them, and it was all very positive, wasn't it?
Yeah, so we met them in London, and you guys might have realised, as we did a podcast interview last, when was it, October?
September it was.
October, September. November?
It was the day that This Is The Place EP came out, and the week after Why Me, Why Not, there you go.
Yeah, and so I said in that, we've had a super secret meeting or something like that, which was, so that was this. So we met these guys and sat on the side of the table. There was three of them kind of sitting like on a sofa in like a hotel lobby, and me and you sat on two chairs and just sort of went, blah, book, Oasis, blah, 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 blah. And the three guys, like these three guys probably in their like 50s, 60s, like sort of, you know, just kind of, you know, looking at each other like, who are these chances? And we both sort of looked at, stopped talking, thought, oh, maybe we should let them actually speak. And then they were like, yeah, okay, sounds great. And it was all a bit, oh really, you sure, okay, all right. I think that the big thing, so obviously there's the fact that, and there's a couple of USPs about this, and I don't just want this to be a thing to flog the book, but yes, buy the book.
Buy the book.
Yeah, there's two aspects to this. There's the fact that, like, number one, no one else has done a History of Oasis book. Why the hell has that not happened? Like, they're the most popular band in the UK, like outside the Beatles and maybe Queen. Like, how has there not been another book about the history of Oasis? That's ridiculous. And number two, it's linked to this podcast, right? Where there's a built-in audience of people that listen to this podcast every week. That, you know, in a demographic, let's get into marketing bullshit to speak. In a demographic of people in their late 30s, early 40s, who have probably got a few quid, you know, in their pockets, that are willing to spend money on books, and ours isn't going to be as expensive as Michael Spencer Jones's book. It was like 60 quid or something. So, you know, there's an audience out there that I can actually talk to. It's not like, oh, well, are we going to get some media? I am media. You know, I speak to if there's a few thousand mad Oasis fans who would pay 25 quid for an Oasis book, they're downloading the podcast already, so I can talk to them every single week. And also, we do live events. I go out and I go out and do this, and people go along and meet Tony and meet McGee or whoever, and get things signed and buy things. It's like, well, I could just do the book at live events and people will buy it, you know? So so that was like, oh, wow, really? You can flog this thing. I was like, well, yeah. So, and then obviously, like, it's really good. You've written it really well. I'll just drop that in.
Well, that's not for me to say, but you're absolutely right. And I mean, I think it certainly would have, as a concept, you know, doing the entire history would have been an interesting concept because no one would have done it before. But I think, you know, there's no escaping from the fact that the the, you know, to use business jargon, the brand you've got allied with the exclusive interviews is very much, as you say, the USP of it. And I think the it was a bit of a perfect storm, really, I think, in terms of finding publishers who specialise. I mean, they do a whole line called, you know, The Day I Was There, and it's quite very chronological. It's very kind of historical focused, and that's kind of in line with what we had done in the first place. Yeah, as I say, the podcast interviews themselves, you know, exclusive, you know, you've got some really good insights and some stories have not been heard. And yeah, I think those two things, it was a bit of a perfect storm, really. And I think that, and, you know, I think that's why This Day Music were keen on it. It's because we knew what we were talking about. I think that was quite key. You know, you had the ready-made audience, you know.
And the book was written, right? Is it, the book was written?
It was done, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like it's not like other people that are like, oh, I've got this idea for a book. Okay, great. Yeah, I might deliver it next year. And can you give me an advance? You know, it's like, well, what? No, we were just like, well, we've already got it. If you want to, if you can do an amazing job with it, make it look amazing and distribute it, like, that would be great. Because as much as, like, I know that people that I've interviewed and stuff that have done these self-published books, I think sometimes it doesn't look as good. You know what I mean? Just the cover, you can tell it's been sort of, you know, printed through one of these companies. It doesn't just have that sheen, that sexiness that it looks like when it's through a proper publisher. And, you know, when you've got someone like This Day in Music, like, they're, what, they've got 500,000 people on likes on Facebook and stuff for their Facebook page. So, you know, it's a massive company. Because we were going to say, right, well, if we can't, if we don't get a publisher for this, well, we could self-publish, you know, and then if you self-publish, obviously you earn a much bigger chunk of every copy you sell. But actually, it's not about the money, is it? It's about getting this really great piece of work out there and chronicling the bloody career of Oasis, which is what I've spent my last 2.5 years doing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was it. I mean, we did talk about it, but I was always inclined to say if we could get a publisher interested, that would be it, because you want, as you say, we wanted it to look good. You know, I think it has to be something, you know, it had to look the part. You know, it was kind of envisaged as a bit of a coffee table book, although 100,000 words, I don't know how feasible that is. We had a big coffee table, but
you need a reinforced iron coffee table.
But it has to warrant what it is. And I try and say this without any arrogance at all, but to warrant, like, the scale of the band and the book itself, it would need to look good. Well, it had to look good, really, to redo it justice. Yeah. So yeah, very happy we've got, you know, publishers with experience behind it who've got, you know, that kind of market and that reach that can warrant it, I think, because you know, as you said, they're one of the biggest bands. Obviously, we love them. I think their legacy deserves this.
Absolutely.
Certainly, in style. Hopefully, the book's the standard.
And getting it into shops as well. That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
A company like this can get it into shops. It'll be on.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It'll be on Amazon. It'll be in selected Waterstones and things like that. Hopefully, you know, we'll you never know until it's done, but that's the plan. You know, these guys have got the reach to get it into shops, which is just amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, I can just imagine this being in, like, Waterstones and things. And when I'm looking around, you know, if people were looking for me for Christmas presents, they haven't got a clue what to get me. Well, now you do. You know what I mean? Every man over, you know, I know it's not all men between the age of 35 and 45, but every man between the age of 35 and 45 probably wants this book, right? So you know, but anyway, but it's not done because we need the listeners' help.
Yes,
Richard,
we do.
Explain.
We do. So the general idea is for it to be well, it's for it to be well illustrated or to be well documented, but within that, we need as many pictures as possible, really. Ticket stubs would be ideal, press clippings, all that sort of thing. Any listeners that have got photographs of members of the band, any personal pieces to them, you know, maybe good crowd shots or good experiences at gigs or whatever, we'd like those to be in the book, because A, it's supposed to be, you know, about the fans, as the podcast has always been, but, you know, B, we might not have to pay quite so much for those images. But also, see, you know, there's a huge fan base out there with a huge resource. You know, similarly, my kind of choice with the cover, we were given options of quite a few pictures, and I thought that cover to me it's not a familiar image of Oasis. You know, it's not the stock thing you see in music press or tabloids or whatever. it's representative of what I wanted the book to be, i.e. it's kind of mid-period then. It's all about non-Liam, let's face it. You know, you could have the whole band shot, but then which band do you have? You know, do you have the pre 2000 version or the Mark II? It's about images and stuff that are unique and that are different and are not found in all other books. And you know, with the following that the podcast has got and the dedicated fan base that we've got, I'm sure there'll be images that we could use. So you know, please send them across to us, and you know, in as high resolution as possible. And I'm actually going through that now. My next job is to work out what images are going to go on what pages to correlate with what parts of the story, and I need pictures, so if people have got them, please let us know.
Thank you very much to Richard. Always a pleasure to catch up. And I hope you guys enjoyed hearing sort of a bit more detail about how this book thing has come together. If you want to get hold of it, then you can pre-order now. The link is in the description. Or if you go to This Day in Books website, you'll see it. It's currently only available for pre-order. I think it's the first 500 is hardcover, signed by the author, it says, which is Richard. But then I think I'll probably try and turn up and scribble on a few of them as well. Or we're going to have various events coming up this year in 2020, live events and other bits and pieces, launch parties for the book and things like that. So if you want to buy one in person and get it signed, then come on down to whatever live events that we haven't announced yet. So but it's really exciting. And you know, as I was saying in the interview there, like, I can't believe it hasn't been done yet. So I'm just really pleased that it will be out there and it's going to be good. It's going to be quality. I know it's going to be good. So so that is fantastic. Right, that will do it for today. Thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast. And most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we get episodes up. Loaded early and also exclusive episodes. The one I just did recently was my ranking of every Gallagher song that came out in 2019. So that went up a few days ago over on Patreon. So if you want to hear that, what did I pick as number one? Was it Wandering Star? Was it Shockwave? Was it Now That I Found You? Was it Evil Flower? I'll give you a clue, it wasn't Evil Flower. Anyway, that's up on Patreon now to go and give it a listen. Just a reminder, if you can subscribe on YouTube as well, there's a couple of YouTube vids going on there. And if we get a bit of traction on YouTube, then I might do some more stuff over there. But if you guys aren't into it, then I won't bother. Do follow me on the socials, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And as ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.